Welcome to You Decide. I'm your host, Errol Lewis. Most of us know Bruce Ratner as a major real estate developer in New York City. He led the firm Forest City Ratner, which built around 50 projects, major projects included, like the New York Times building, the Metrotech office complex in downtown Brooklyn, a Frank Gehry apartment tower, and of course, the Barclays Center, where the Nets lose. the Brooklyn Nets play. Massive projects, they all helped shape the city. There was a stretch, though, in the mid-2000s when he was in the headlines, not always favorably, trying to get the Atlantic Yards project off the ground and get that arena built. It was later renamed Pacific Park. I wrote about that a lot. I thought Ratner was more right than wrong. I thought the project was something that the area needed. And it's an accomplished fact now. I think it worked out all for the best. Anyway, Ratner was even a minority owner of those Brooklyn Nets for a little while. But that's not what today's episode is about. Ratner also founded, more recently, the Michael D. Ratner Center for Early Detection of Cancer. And that's in memory of his brother, in order to advance the cause of expanding life-saving cancer screening, as well as research into new diagnostic tests. It turns out that we've had a lot of people die of cancer, but not nearly enough attention is being paid to ways to increase the amount of early detection that would have saved their lives. Mr. Ratner is promoting early detection tests, especially for lung cancer in low-income and underserved populations. He's even co-written a book about it. It's called Early Detection, Catching Cancer When It Is Curable. It was published by OR Books. And he's got a co-author, Adam Bonislawski, and they argue together that catching cancer early is the single best way to fight the disease. But most resources, when you give a grant to the Cancer Society and so forth, are devoted to late-stage treatments or deep research into what caused the cancer in the first place, whereas the detection would have saved a lot more lives if we could focus on it a little bit more systematically. So I sat down with Bruce Ratner before a packed house at the Center for Brooklyn History. Here's our conversation. Thank you, everybody, for coming out. I'm Errol Lewis. I'm the political anchor at Spectrum News New York One. We are always very happy to be part of the conversations that happen off camera because they enable us to go a little bit more in depth. A few weeks ago, Bruce and I had one of those rushed 8 to 12 minute TV conversations. And afterwards, I said, you know, we're going to have to do this again. And he said, oh, well, by coincidence, we have an opportunity to do exactly that. And so we thank you for doing that. And Bruce, we've had a number of different adventures over the years in trying to get different projects built and the different controversies. This is, of course, a different fight. And for those who don't know, because this is going to go far and wide beyond this, people do know you as the developer from Forest City Ratner, the New York Times building, the Atlantic Center, and so forth. But you're fully out of that business at this point, right?
I am out of that business at this point, yes.
So, Bruce, the book starts with a discussion of how your brother, Michael Ratner, got a sudden diagnosis of cancer. You talk about what an awful and elusive disease cancer is. It comes and it goes. It disguises itself. It surprises you. It comes back again and again. And it sounded fairly traumatic, even though, as you point out in the book, you had access to the best care that's available here in New York.
So I always thought that cancer was curable, especially these days with immunotherapies and so on. And then I'm away and I get a call from my brother, Michael, who is a well-known human rights lawyer. We're a year and a half apart. We were very much together in everything we did. In fact, Reverend Daughtry went to Nicaragua with Michael many, many years ago. And so when Michael called me, I was away, and he said he had just had a brain scan because he was sick to his stomach. And they gave him a brain scan, and he had a tumor in his brain, a metastatic tumor from some other place. I flew right home. I had the very best care you could possibly have at Sloan Kettering. He was supposed to live only for about 3 weeks, but they did various things to keep him alive for 8 months. But I thought it was curable. I would say to Michael, if you can hang in here 4 to 6 months, there's going to be a drug that's going to save you. And what happened was I found out that that was not the case. And I also found out in that the head of Sloan Kettering's basically medical director said to me, you know, Bruce, we can catch cancer early and stop this. And that got me going. And that was 8 years ago. So 8 years ago, it was really when this quest started. And it was from Michael that it made a big difference, obviously.
And so you point out that from that example, and that of course you found many others, that
clinically speaking, we're fighting a rearguard battle after the disease has already begun destroying organs, as opposed to early detection. And that might have made all the difference with Michael.
Yes. Had they found Michael's cancer early, and it was doable, we kind of know where it did start, and some doctor sort of passed it by. We've all had that experience of saying, this is not important, you don't have cancer, and the person was wrong. So that's a good example of what happens to so many of us. There's a symptom, there's something that happens, and someone tells us to ignore it, or we don't know what the symptoms should be. And more importantly, most cancers you find when they're symptomatic, and usually they're in stage 3 or 4. You've got to catch them early. So that's kind of what I learned, and what these banners, in a way, I don't have to say very much. They sort of speak for themselves. This first set of banners, look at the number of people who die, who get cancer, and the number of people who die from cancer. It's extraordinary. In fact, the fact is, every minute, somebody in this country dies of cancer. So if this lasts 40 minutes, 40 people will die of cancer. And it's a rearguard action. You're absolutely right. We actually are accustomed to treating disease after it's symptomatic. That's pretty much every disease, if you think about it.
By contrast, you point out that heart disease dropped from 1950 to the present time, about 2019, or the numbers you have in the book, from 588 per 100,000 in 1950 to about 161 per 100,000 in 2019. And by contrast, cancer mortality has only dropped slightly over the last four decades. Why the difference in those outcomes?
Well, one thing you have to think about is heart disease. There's a number of preventive things we do. We do statins, we do blood pressure, we do diabetes, we get checked all the time, everything, sonograms, the whole thing. And so that's not the case with cancer. We don't really have a statin. No one can check us for blood pressure, and that's not related to cancer or diabetes and so on. What's done incredibly well in heart disease is really different types of things like statin, as well as diet, as well as exercise. All those things are preventative of heart disease. We don't have anything quite like that, or if we do, most people don't practice it.
And there are a couple of reasons for that that you hint at in the book, and I wanted to talk about a little bit. The big national war on cancer declared by President Nixon in 1971, I was somewhat conscious. I was in elementary school, but I remember there was the war in Southeast Asia, and there was the war on drugs, and there was the war on poverty that he was kind of moving away from. I don't remember this declaration of a war on cancer, but in any event, you say it hasn't really gone all that well over the last 50 years.
Basically, you've had no reduction in mortality and cancer since 1950, with the exception of cessation of smoking. That has caused the drop in cancer. I've heard the head of large hospitals say, well, we've reduced cancer by 27% over the last 8 years. That's because of smoking. They don't say that, cessation of smoking. They act as if there's a treatment that actually did it, and that's not the case.
And so there's this immense emphasis on funding scientific research, efforts to find a quote-unquote cure, but then you raise the question in the book, what's the point of all the research if we don't put it to use? And I think at least one of the slides up here shows that only a small fraction of the amount spent on research actually goes to finding applications for it.
This chart right over here says it all. This $25 billion is the amount of revenue that immunotherapy Keytruda collects a year, $25 billion. National Cancer Institute, $7.3 billion. Early detection, you can't even see the dot, it's about the size of my fingernail, $600 million. So the problem is we spend a lot on treatments for advanced cancers. Now, let me just say something. I have the good fortune of working with the people at Sloan Kettering, and I've never seen such extraordinary scientists and physicians. They are incredible. They create miracles, and the science is extraordinary. They understand a huge amount about what causes cancer, the notion of cancer, and so on and so forth. But it's 50 diseases, and every single cancer in every person is slightly different than another one. So they're going against very difficult circumstances, but they are really good at what they do. The big problem is not enough money is spent on early detection. And if we spent that kind of money, $7.5 billion a year on early detection, we'd have a very, very different situation.
So now you're on the board of many of these institutions. You come to the table with an important reputation in this town. What were those conversations like as you began to ask them, hey guys, I'm fine with writing you another check, but at some point we have to ask, what's this all for if we're not moving the numbers?
Well, the very first board meeting, I went to one of those places. I'm sitting there and They're announcing that there's a new drug they have that extends life for 3 months. Everybody was incredibly excited. And that was the first time I began to realize something's wrong. I've never had the guts to talk too much about that fact until recently, until I wrote the book. And now what's happening, Sloan Kettering is starting an early detection program. They're doing it with a hospital in Queens, Jamaica Hospital, which is an extraordinary place. And we're really, I donated the money to do screening at that hospital to create a model for screening. And they are into it now in a big way. And I'm very happy about that. They understand the importance of early detection. And when you actually speak to the doctors, every one of them supports early detection. They would rather operate on someone in stage one than stage four. They want to see people live. They care deeply about their patients. So they do believe in early detection. It's just that it's never been something that's been pushed. And frankly, there's a very good quote by a very famous Dr. Vogelstein that says that if I find a cure for colon cancer, I get a ticker tape parade. If I create a prevention from getting colon cancer, nobody notices. So that's part of the problem. There's a lot of glory in curing advanced cancers. There's not a lot of glory in actually preventing cancer.
We also point out that in, you know, the numbers from 2000, but if anything, it's probably bigger now, that cancer deaths were estimated to have removed $960 billion in economic value from this country. I mean, this is major. This is not just,
almost, yeah.
I mean, that rises to the level, it seems to me, where politicians would start to notice, where, you know, if you're losing almost $1 trillion in economic value on a yearly basis, that's got to be a drag on the economy, if nothing
else.
Well,
as I said when I was younger, too much on defense. No, that was in a different year, and I was a very progressive person then. But
you were right, by the way.
But anyhow, so you're absolutely right. It's not, I don't understand why there isn't greater emphasis on it. I really don't. I don't think people understand really what the statistics are. If they understood the difficult, we get the word breakthrough every single day in the newspaper. Breakthrough, the cancers, we finally got a cure for it. So there's all this press about breakthroughs, new ideas, and most of it turns out to never be followed through with a case. So many of us are misled, including me. We think there are cures for advanced cancer. There really are. Now, let me qualify that. There are percentages of people who do get cured, especially at places like Sloan Kettering, which brings me to the disparity issue. If one goes to a Sloan Kettering, you have a high likelihood, even in stage four, of getting a reasonably high survival. On the other hand, if you go to, say, a community hospital, your chances of survival are much lower. The disparities in healthcare generally are extraordinary, and they're extraordinarily important to think about the disparities with respect to prevention and early detection. 40% of women with breast cancer in a study in Boston had a higher mortality than white women, even though they had the same incidence of cancer. 40% higher mortality. One more number. Washington, D.C., people on Medicaid, the average person on Medicaid, when they get a diagnosis of cancer, only 47% actually get treated. So only 50% of the people on Medicaid who get cancer in Washington, D.C. get treated. And there's a host of reasons for that. Social determinants, a very big word, which has to do with jobs, work, crime. Actually, people call it the cancer continuum. I call it the cancer labyrinth. It's impossible. Any of us, all of us have in the same place. We all have parents, family members who have had cancer. We've all seen it. We've seen what they've gone through. Finding a doctor, going to all those appointments, getting the infusions, making sure that you, if you have a side effect, somebody take there to take care of you. And so the answer is that with the disparity, if you're an underserved person, you are not going to be able to get the kind of care that you get at a Sloan Kettering. And more of that, you just don't have the people around you that have the examples. You have a job to go to. You've got kids to raise. You know, the best example I ever heard was the talk about the homeless person who lost his shoe, he or she, and they walk around in the city and they get an infection. They have to go to the hospital. It costs about $10,000 to get rid of that infection, say, make a number up. In the European countries, guess what? They give you a new shoe. They have a safety net that works. They have twice the safety net in dollars that we have. And so people often think that we have a most expensive system. We have the most expensive system, but ours does not include the safety nets. If you add the safety nets for the European countries to their healthcare, they will actually wind up spending more than we do and getting a lot more for it. So those are just part of the disparities issues. Disparities issues are so serious. If you actually eliminated the disparities, you would probably reduce the amount of cancer mortality by 20%.
On the subject of the disparities, you point to some people who are really heroes, unsung heroes. And you mentioned Dr. Harold Freeman, who I actually did interview a long time ago. He starts doing breast cancer screenings at Harlem Hospital, kind of on his own. Saw that a lot of his patients were missing out on screenings because they were going downtown, waiting on long lines. They couldn't afford to get away from their childcare obligations to get a little card so that their Medicaid would pay for a screening and on and on and on. And he launches what becomes the first patient navigator system in the U.S., which is now, you know, ordinary, right? Or now fully accepted as the right way to do it, to help guide people through this labyrinth. And that was born out of these disparities. What has been your experience when you find and sort of point to these kind of innovations, if you want to call it that, like sort of on the ground?
Well, let's talk about Harold Freeman again, if that's okay, mm-hmm. and about what he did. Harold Freeman was an African-American. He went to Howard Medical School. He went to work for Sloan Kettering. And he said, no, I want to work in the Harlem Hospital. And here's what he did. He saw patients and he would find they came in advanced cancers, breast cancers. And so he opened a clinic on a Saturday morning, every Saturday morning, and people would come in. And then he realized that with all the different things to get through that labyrinth, they needed an advisor. And he started the notion of patient navigators. And that concept has caught on. There's not enough of it, which I'll talk about in a minute. But that is the Band-Aid. Linda gave it the name. The Band-Aid for closing the gap in disparities. Because if you have someone who tells you which doctor to go to, helps you get insurance, helps you get help for your children, helps you on income, helps you on going through that terrible labyrinth, you will have a very likely higher chance of survival. Just to give you a sense, when he started, only 6% of the people who came in for breast cancer were in stage 1 or 2. Majority were in 3 and 4. After they had patient navigators, 41% came in stage 1 or 2. That's what kind of difference he made. Now, the problem is that insurance doesn't cover patient navigators. I want to accept that. Just this year, an amazing thing happened. They agreed to pay for an hour and a half a month of patient navigators, which doesn't do anything. The point is, patient navigators is probably the single most important thing for closing the issues with disparities. And one of the things we're going to work on, and Linda's helping with this, is trying to increase the number of patient navigators. Because, for example, the hospitals can't afford it. Actually, all the studies show that if you have a patient navigator, the hospital saves money. Just think about cancellations for colonoscopies. 30% of the people in colon that are supposed to get colonoscopies don't show up. 95% show up when they have a patient navigator. Just the savings on the cost of people not getting screened or the cost of bringing a whole group out in order to get your colonoscopy. If you avoid that, you save a lot of money. And so every study has shown that patient navigators save at least their salary, probably double their salary. And yet that's not being done. So one of our jobs as our initiatives is to push this issue with patient navigators and make sure people understand that we've got to change that. It has to be changed. That is the greatest, we say Band-Aid, to the fact that we have social determinants, which we're all unhappy about, but which are very hard to change.
The company I work for, Charter Communications, is the parent company. They have about 100,000 employees nationwide. I would think that they would have a fair amount of bargaining power, our company and others like it, to go to an insurance company and say, you know, we need navigators as part of this, whatever we're going to buy from you, because without it, we're going to go next door. We'll go and find your competitor.
So it turns out there is an organization, nonprofit, that rates health plans. It's called HEDIS, H-E-D-I-S. And probably 70% of all health plans are rated by this organization. Unfortunately, for example, doing breast cancer screening, mammography, you're rated as to whether or not your insurance policy covers that. Unfortunately, HEDIS does not include patient navigation as one of the criteria for whether or not a health policy is good or bad. If we can change HEDIS, we will do a huge amount of difference because then you have a competition. If you want to get the highest possible score, you've got to touch all of the different things that are important. And that makes people buy insurance or companies like yours buy insurance.
You know, I've noticed that there are these concierge health services. Amazon's trying to get into this space now. There's a company called Forward. And they charge, I don't know, $80 to $150 a month for what amounts to something similar to a patient navigator.
That's a really good point that I actually never thought of. Concierge medicine is a form of patient navigator. The difference is, many of us can afford that, and most of us cannot. So that's the problem. And, you know, that's a very good analogy to use that I hadn't thought of. You're absolutely right. We do have patient navigators if you can afford it. We have concierge medicine. But it actually, think about it. Most people cannot afford that. And so that's why patient navigators are so important. And even, frankly, the concierge doctors very often refer something. They don't take you through the whole continuum. We need people to take you through the whole continuum.
You reference the innovations that have improved early detection of breast cancer screenings, pap smears, colonoscopies. It has statistically reduced those cancers to 90-plus percent five-year survival rates. That's not looking at another country. That's not looking at another economic system. That's not looking at Sweden, right? That's looking at what we ourselves have done. Why don't those become the template or the model for what the overall system
Let's take something relatively simple, because not simple, but something we know a lot about, pap smears. It took 60 years, 1928 to 1988, until pap smears were fully accepted and effective and actually used by a lot of people. It took everything from, I'll give you an example, the reading of a pap smear was being done in the 70s and 60s by women because they didn't have a lot of job choice. And they were getting paid 50 cents per slide. And that is not a living wage, to say the least. And the result of that is they would do 200 slides a day to make a living. That doesn't work. So finally, Congress passed a law limiting as to how many slides you can read and actually insisting that each lab be certified by the government. So that helped it. And the American Cancer Society did a huge push on pap smears, and that got a cancer, which was probably the deadliest cancer to women in the early part of the 1900s, than any other cancer, down to a 2% rate of mortality for pap smears.
And I mean, I did not realize that we call it a pap smear, but it's named after Papanicolaou. He deserves a ticker tape parade.
He sure does. And it was not easy for him. He first proposed his idea, and no one took it seriously. He was actually a salesman at Macy's, because when he came here, that's the job he, and someone discovered him. He went to what's now Weill Cornell, and somebody said, wow, you've got this incredible test. What is it? And that was the beginning of a long process. Lung cancer screening was first discovered, the low-dose CT scan, in 1995, and it's now, what, it's almost 30 years old, and only 5% of the people who are eligible for lung cancer screening actually get screened. So that's one where it's now 30 years later, it still is not accepted. It's not pushed by the government. On the other hand, mammography, people do use it. Colonoscopies, very important, and people do actually get colonoscopies. Actually, colonoscopies and similar kinds of tests like the Cologuard test have cut colon cancer in half, which is extraordinary. And that took a lot of publicity, a $300 million campaign by CDC to push colon cancer and Katie Kirk getting a colonoscopy in front of the world. That made the difference. And so, yes, those are are good successes. They took a long time.
You say about lung cancer that social stigma may be attached to smoking, and that might account for the differential treatment, the lack of a big marketing campaign for people to go in and get the LDCT.
The problem actually is the low-dose CT scans have been a matter of controversy for years and years with different doctors. Some say that low-dose CT scans, which is the way to find out if you have lung cancer in case you're a smoker, there's been a lot of boo-birds, negativity towards lung cancer screening. And that has stopped the government from both doing the kind of campaign we need. I find doctors, a very famous doctor that some people know, Eric Topols, he's head of Scripps. I saw a quote in the New York Times 5 years ago saying lung cancer screening doesn't work. That's just incorrect. By the way, if you have ever smoked in your life to any great extent, even if it was 30 years ago, you need to get screened, and you need to get screened every year. You often hear, don't bother to get screened. You haven't smoked for 15, 20 years. That is not true. For the first time, the American Cancer Society came out in November saying, no matter how long ago it was that you smoked, you need to get screened if you were a smoker 25 years ago or 30 years ago. And think about it. Think about all the people we know who've gotten lung cancer who haven't smoked for years and years and years. So one of the things people often ask me, what can I do? You've got to ask everybody you know, did you ever smoke before? If the answer is yes, or they're still smoking, you've got to make sure they take a low-dose CT scan, and it's got to be done every year. A quick story, a very good friend of Linda's and mine. We were on a vacation with him. She read the book and she said, oh, about 25, 30 years ago, I smoked and I smoked a lot. She decided to get screened. Lo and behold, they discovered a cancer, but it was stage one. She was 2 days in the hospital and she's fine. That's what early detection will do. And that's why if you do any single thing, talk to people about lung cancer, having smoked. It's 25% of all mortality in cancer is lung cancer. So, yeah.
Although you point out only 3% of lung cancers are detected through screening. Right. And we're losing 130,000 people a year to this.
Right. The truth is, so one of the questions is what's the initiative that Linda and I are working on really? One of them is to increase lung cancer screening in this city. And there are various techniques and ideas that we have that we're beginning to start. And I hope eventually the city will pick it up because it is critical. And it's a particularly a disparity issue. You have more African-American smoking than you do people who are Caucasian or don't happen to be African-American. And that's particularly important. And that's why lung cancer screening is really critical.
Yeah, talk to me about this. I spend a lot of time talking about and surfacing issues on the theory that at some point, a political entrepreneur of some kind will pick them up and run with it. Whether it's an elected official or somebody who wants to get elected or somebody who wants to stay elected or an activist, there are a lot of people who have a lot of incentives to find the kind of issues you're talking about here and lifting them up. Here within the city, has there been any interest? Have you heard from people who said, hey,
we have a mayor. We have a mayor who is incredibly interested in health. And when I was in this building and I had a breakfast with him, he talked about health. He is very concerned about health. He has a program to reduce cancer over a period of time. I don't remember how many years. He's got a whole panel that basically works on trying to reduce cancer in this city. So I think his mind is in the right place. We're going to talk to him about a whole program with a big radiology center that I think will really help on this issue. And he will be a person who will speak out on it. But you're right. Other than the mayor, I don't know very many. Teddy Kennedy was one. Obviously died of brain cancer, but he was one that talked a lot about cancer. Other than that, you don't find it very often, which is shocking because we're all affected by it.
You have a chapter called Death by Zip Code, and that speaks less to geography itself than to what happens in certain neighborhoods, right?
Right. So as I keep saying, this disparity issue, you could call it zip codes, is a way to say it, and I call that chapter that. But again, it goes to everything. It goes to the issue of crime in a neighborhood. It goes to diet. It goes to food deserts. It goes to racism, bias, that people don't even realize they're biased. I've seen meetings where the issue of bias comes up and where doctors say, well, we can't help bias. And yet I know that when we do surveys at one of the particular places I'm involved with, it turns out that African-American women give us the lowest grades with respect to the quality of care. And it's not because they necessarily got worse care. It's because of implicit bias. And that's not a minor issue in the case of healthcare. In fact, I think it's probably one of the biggest issues. You get African-Americans treated differently than white people without even the doctor realizing what he or she is doing. So
one of the success stories, you have a couple of success stories that I wanted to talk about. One involves Delaware. Speaking of black-white mortality gap, the black-white mortality gap for colorectal cancer was basically closed within a relatively short period of time, and that involved intensive screening of black residents.
Yes, it did. It basically Delaware had one of the worst cancer rates, but more important, the disparity issue was gigantic. I think it was like 20% of white people died of cancer versus 30% of black people in a particular, say, for colon cancer. And that got closed, and it closed because the state government did something amazing. They put a consortium together of organizations, local organizations, elected leaders. They did tons of advertising. They paid if someone was uninsured for cancer treatment. They made sure to get people screened. And in a relatively short period of time, they completely closed the gap. Now, that problem is Delaware's 1 million people. And we have a city of 8.5 million. So it's a lot more difficult to try and think through. But that's what a state is capable of doing.
You also talk about Leahy Hospital, Burlington, Massachusetts, this involving the lung cancer screening,
right.
Low-dose CT. They screened over 7,700 patients, and it led to a lot more catching stage one cancers, which is actually a victory compared with finding people in stage four.
Yes, and Leahy was really the leader in lung cancer screening and still is. It has a lung cancer screening rate, I think, of probably 30 or 40%, maybe even 50% of people who smoke or used to smoke. I think the most important one of all, though, is Kaiser Permanente. Kaiser Permanente is a healthcare system out west, which has about 13 million people enrolled. It is one big organization, which is everything from insurance to hospital to primary care and so on. And here's what they do. They have what's called a capitation model. Someone pays, or through their insurance, the insurance company pays them a fixed amount per member, $8,000. And for that, they get everything covered. Now, what does that mean? They have to do preventive medicine or else they don't want to catch stage four cancers. It's too expensive for them. So they have a whole preventive aspect to them. You come in with a broken finger and they'll say, are you up to date on mammograms? Are you up to date on lung cancer screening? Are you up to date on pap smears? They're the only one that does that. The second thing is they treat everybody according to a formula almost. And that has cut out the disparities. There's no disparities in that Kaiser system. And we don't have that. We don't have that almost on any other hospital I know. The one in Jamaica that we're working with is to some extent that way. But Kaiser Permanente has the right idea. They own their own insurance company. It started actually because shipbuilders were being injured and so on. And they had a doctor and they had to keep paying him and they couldn't pay him anymore. So finally, for a fixed amount of money, he agreed to take care of all their needs. And that created preventive ideas. And that started Kaiser Permanente.
You say, Bruce, that screenings need to be smart, coordinated, comprehensive, and consistent. I don't associate those words with government, unfortunately, after four decades of covering it. And that's in part because administrations turn over every few years. There are a lot of different variables that are floating around, right? On the other hand, they're the ones who have the scale to really move the needle on this. How do we fix that?
So how do we fix it with respect to the city or state?
Whatever level you think we can get a breakthrough on.
So I think we can fix it, for example, in this city. I think in the federal government, it's much more difficult. Why? What happened was Biden made his moonshot proposal. And the first year was $250 million he devoted to cancer. The next year, which is this year, so far the House divided, decided they wouldn't approve the next $250 million. So for the first time, cancer has gotten politicized in our federal government, in our legislatures. That is not true of our city. That's not true of our state. And that is really, I think, the place to work at, particularly here in the city. In the city, we can do it. This city, as you and I know, Errol, much more organized than we think. There's community groups that there's everything from the housing communities, which have their own presidents. We have so many different organizations, church groups and so on, that we can do it here. If we organize, we have the ability, we have the desire, and we have people that care in the city. And so I think this is a city that we can help increase screening to an extraordinary extent. I don't think it's as easy to deal with the disparity in the hospitals and so on. That's a big problem, a bigger problem than almost anybody can solve. But I do think on screening and prevention, we can do it in this city.
Well, we've got 11 public hospitals too, right? I mean, that's not a small thing for a proof of concept, right?
The problem is it's very difficult, frankly, to work with the Health and Hospitals Corporation, not because they're bad. They're very, very good. It's an issue of priorities for them. They're overwhelmed with really people who have cancer, with all kinds of other diseases. And so I think we are going to approach them. They are the ones to do it. They are capable of doing it. I've actually was special counsel to one after I worked for the city for about 4 years, and they can do it. The health and hospitals are overloaded, obviously. Look at Bellevue, what a good hospital that is. It's a very good hospital. Mm-hmm. King County could use some improvement, but they could do it. I think that's a very good way to look at it and a very good approach.
I went online as I was getting ready for tonight after reading the book, and I found a private company, Illumina, I think is the parent company, but you can get a blood-based test from a single draw. That's the good news. The bad news, I think it was online, you can get it for about $949.
Yes, okay. Yeah, so let's talk about the most important thing, I guess, the future. So there are things called MCEDs, multi-cancer early detection. And that's a single blood test, not pricking your finger, it's a tube, not like somebody else. And you give a tube of blood and they can analyze it and you can detect over 50 cancers. And the biggest company now is called Grail. They seem to be leading the way. There's another company called Exact Sciences. The big deal is MCEDs. A lot of private money is going into them. And I believe that is absolutely the only viable future for changing everything. Imagine taking a blood test. It can detect 50 cancers, and you can know in advance, and you do stage shift instead of catching in stage 4, you catch in stage 1 or 2. The UK has bought 140,000 of these tests to begin to test it out on UK residents to see if it works the way it's supposed to work. And that test will be over in about 3 years. Hopefully, our government will follow that and do the same thing. But it's a subject, just like all the others, that's controversial. I hear people complaining about it. One of the problems is that it doesn't detect every cancer as well as the next. So, for example, in the case of, say, thyroid cancer, it'll only pick up about 20% of stage 1 thyroid cancers. By stage 3, it picks up a lot. On the other hand, pancreatic, one of our scariest cancers, and ovarian cancer, again, one of the silent killers. You don't find it until it's often too late. It'll detect up to 60% of stage 1 ovarian cancers. So it's a really important test. Our government has not done a very good job in pushing it. In fact, quite the opposite. They've sued it for antitrust, which is extraordinary. It's a whole separate discussion because there's a lot of competition. There's a lot of doctors that don't believe in it and so on. But it is really, I think, the future. It has to be the future. We can't have 20 tests for 20 different cancers and expect all day long to get a lung cancer screen today, tomorrow, a mammography, and so on. We need to have one test that can detect a lot of cancers. And the good news is it's being developed. A lot of money is going into it. And I think we will have a good answer in the next 3 to 4 years. I'm not saying it's going to cure. I don't know how many times I've heard that, but I'm hoping that it will do well. That's the best way to say it.
Well, but if there's a decent test that comes up, and no matter what they're charging for it now, the price is going to probably come down, right?
Oh, let me talk. I'm sorry. Yeah. Yes. Right now, there are bills in both the Senate and the House with probably 150 sponsors in the House and probably 80 sponsors in the Senate to have these tests covered by Medicare and Medicaid and insurance companies. It has to be approved first by the FDA, but then I think it will pass both houses. So that has to happen because one of the problems with this testing is it actually creates more disparities because people can't afford it. So if you're poor, you wind up in, I call it the tale of two healthcares. You wind up over here. If you can afford it, you get the test. And so we do not want that to happen with these very important tests. So I'm really glad you brought that up.
Right. And I'm just assuming that just as we had the early problems in the pandemic with tests where they weren't available, there was no pipeline, there were multiple different ones, people were trying to make money out of it. By the end of the pandemic, which is really only like, say, 3 to 4 years later, the government is sending them through the post office, which is what they should have done in the first place, probably, right? Do you see a future where something like that happens here?
Well, I think here's a story. So the answer is the whole world basically could use that test. That's a gigantic market. And the insurance companies would cover it. So I think the reason why these companies are getting such a big investment is obviously people think that they can eventually make a lot of money because the test is really everyone will have to get it or will want to get it. So I think we're not going to have to worry as much. The capitalist system will work in that case. Contrary to my days at Columbia from 1967 to 1970, when I didn't believe in that whole concept. But I do believe that it works now in many cases.
Okay. Your proposals include a major marketing effort, and you don't touch on this specifically in the book, but I wonder how you think about the branch of journalism that deals with medical institutions, medicine and health and wellness in general.
Well, first of all, I don't really read widely enough on the whole healthcare system I can talk about. I mean, people here probably know more than I do about journalism and healthcare and its reporting. I do know that in the case of early detection, the quality of the reporting is actually not very good. There was an article recently in the Wall Street Journal, headline, Lung Cancer to be Conquered. And you read the article and the things she has in it are just wrong. I made a decision. It was too much trouble and hard to try and correct it, but it would have appeared nowhere. But the quality of the reporting, frankly, on early detection, you really could use some help.
Okay. I teach at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism, and these kind of questions, you know.
They're interesting questions.
Yeah, we'll train some people or make it available to them anyway. Better training of providers and technicians. You mentioned before how many years underpaid technicians and undertrained, frankly, technicians were in charge of pap smears. We have a similar problem now. What's the answer to that?
Well, we have problems really everywhere in the area of training and so on. Let's just take a couple examples. In the case of breast cancer mammography, a reader, that is a radiologist, needs to do to be certified 480 mammographies a year, reading of mammograms, as opposed to the UK to get certified 5,000 mammograms you have to read. Average urologist does a median number of prostatectomies of 3 a year. You need to do 250 lifetime in order to be qualified so that you don't have a recurrence when you operate. Here's the problem. We have a fractionalized, fragmented healthcare system, as opposed to the UK has a uniform system. So when they give a directive like everybody has a right to be screened, should be screened for the following four cancers, it happens. They come out with a comment that there's this new test, say blood test, that can find 50 cancers, take it. Every GP knows they have to say that in the UK, a singular system. Here, we have a divided system, fragmented system, no uniform protocols, no uniform requirements, and we have 50 states and God knows how many health departments, each with separate rules, separate protocols. There's four separate protocols for what you ought to do in terms of when you ought to take a mammogram. Some say age 40, some say age 45, some say every 2 years, some say every 1 year. So we have a fragmented system, which frankly, there's no real way to fix it. We do have 50 states. We have health departments all over the place. And so it's a tremendous disadvantage that we have. Whereas in Europe, they can give a single directive for so many different important things, including screening. And it's a problem with the healthcare system.
Wow. Any last words? Is there a call to action for those of us who want to help?
Well, the way it was, get screened, get screened, get screened. Now, that's because I'm in real estate, location, location, location. So get screened, get screened, get screened, and tell everybody else to get screened. I guess that's the best advice I could give, to make sure to talk to everybody about it and the importance, of people who smoke. And, you know, prostate is a very simple test. Mammography is a painful but a simple test, and that's really important. And we cut down a lot of cancers that way. And hopefully we'll get there on the other cancers, on pancreatic and ovarian in particular. So,
okay. And those who want the details, it's in the book. Bruce Ratner will be here for a little bit afterwards. But yes, join me in thanking him. Thank you very much, Bruce.
Thank you for everything.
I really appreciate it.
That's going to do it for this episode of You Decide. As always, I thank you for listening. This episode was produced by me and Anthony Roman and Maria Abadi. Our executive producer is Bob Hart. It was edited by James Asciutto, and our theme music was composed and performed by Terrence Holloman Lewis. I'd love to hear your thoughts about this episode or any of the others. You can find me on social media at Errol Lewis, or leave a message for me at 212-379-3440. And you can also send us email at yourstoryny1@charter.com. And if you're looking for more analysis of New York politics, you should subscribe to and listen to my colleague's podcast called Off Topic on Politics. Those episodes come out every Friday. I'll be back next week. We'll see you then.